Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
This is a reminder that The Path Went Chilly is a discussion podcast in which myself, Ashley, and Jules have in-depth conversations about cases I previously covered on The Trail Went Cold. If you're someone who prefers solo podcasts involving one person, my original Trail Went Cold episodes are available for download. But if you're someone who likes discussion-style podcasts and wants to hear myself, Ashley, and Jules get way more in-depth into these cases I previously covered, then The Path Went Chilly is the podcast for you. Welcome back to The Path Went Chilly. I'm Robin.
I'm Jules.
And I'm Ashley. I can't take the suspense, so let's jump right into the case.
June 18th, 1977, Tucson, Arizona. After disappearing from his family for 11 days, the body of 39-year-old escrow company owner Chuck Morgan is found outside his vehicle in the desert. He's been shot in the back of the head and is carrying a $2 bill, which appears to have a coded message written on it. Even though Chuck is wearing a bulletproof vest and had allegedly survived a kidnapping ordeal 3 months earlier, the police rule his death to be a suicide. 13 years later, a Phoenix man named Doug Johnson is murdered, the apparent victim of a mistaken contract hit intended for a journalist investigating Chuck Morgan's death, but neither case is ever solved.
After that, The Path Went Chilly. So today we're going to be sharing the unique story of two unsolved cold cases which are connected in a very unique way. The first case involved the alleged suicide of a man named Chuck Morgan, but there were so many bizarre details and events surrounding his death that his family believed he was the victim of foul play. Naturally, Unsolved Mysteries jumped at the opportunity to feature this case on their show, but it may have inadvertently paved the way to the death of a man named Doug Johnston, who became the victim of an execution-style murder just over 2 months after the episode aired. Believe it or not, Unsolved Mysteries would eventually produce an all-new segment about Doug Johnston's murder and its potential connection with Chuck Morgan's death. On the surface, there would appear to be no link between these two men at all, as their deaths took place nearly 13 years apart from one another, but the whole thing wound up evolving into a very deep rabbit hole, and we're going to be discussing both these cases on this episode. I covered it on The Trail Went Cold way back in October of 2016, but I thought it would be fun to revisit it on The Path Went Chilly. Even if you're a skeptic about conspiracy theories, this story is probably going to make you do a double take, and Ashley, I have a feeling this is going to garner more WTF reactions than any other story we've covered thus far.
Wow. Okay, well, you're setting me up for a huge bar to meet because this idea that this would give more WTF reactions than other crazy stories we've covered is shocking. Although I'm already sitting here with a twisted, confused face that these two men, this many years apart, are somehow tied to one another. But do you really think that the Unsolved Mystery episode, the very first one, could have caused Doug Johnson's death? Because that's tragic.
It is possible because it got national exposure and started to jumpstart the investigation again. So it's possible that they tried to kill someone who was investigating Chuck Morgan's death and Doug Johnston kind of got caught in the crossfire. But I'll provide more details later on.
Oh, my gosh. All right, let's do it.
We've teased this one in another episode. Robin went into some of the bizarre details and then he was like, oh, we've got to cover this. Ashley's just going to go crazy because it's just so bizarre, and there's no explanation that is a simple explanation here.
Oh, Lord have mercy. Well, this is going to be fun.
So our story begins in Tucson, Arizona in 1977, and our central figure is 39-year-old Charles Curtis Morgan, who goes by the name Chuck. Chuck currently lives with his 44-year-old wife, Ruth, with whom he's been married to for 19 years, and their four daughters, and has spent most of his career working as an escrow officer for a number of local firms. In January of this year, Chuck was fired from his job at Western Title Insurance after a personality clash with his supervisor, but he is now in the midst of acquiring controlling interest in the escrow company Statewide Escrow Services Incorporated. On March 22nd, Chuck dropped off his two daughters at school and was supposedly on his way to his office when he vanished without explanation.
For the next 2 days, his family had no idea what happened to him until around 2 a.m. on March the 25th, when Chuck suddenly came stumbling back into their house. He looked like he had been through a major ordeal, as he was very dirty, his hands were bound with a set of plastic handcuffs, he had one plastic handcuff attached to one of his ankles, and he was missing a shoe. When Ruth asked her husband what happened, he did not say anything, as he simply pointed to his throat and implied that he could not talk. Ruth asked Chuck if he could write, and he nodded yes, so he grabbed himself a pen and paper and proceeded to write out a crazy story. According to Chuck, he had been kidnapped by people who painted his throat with a hallucinogenic drug and caused his tongue to become swollen, rendering him unable to speak. This drug could conceivably drive him insane or destroy his nervous system and kill him.
So is this where I insert WTF?
Yep, that's your first WTF moment.
What in the world? Okay, so just set this up for me, because to me, like, an escrow officer is someone who's like handling real estate claims or something like that. Is this just billionaire, like really important guy? Why would anyone want to kidnap somebody like this?
He's not really a millionaire or billionaire per se. Like, he handles a lot of rich clients and he was apparently very good at escrow work. But as we're going to talk about later on, he apparently had some pretty shady clients during this time period and may have found out information he wasn't supposed to know. And that would probably explain why he would be kidnapped under these circumstances.
God bless. I can just imagine his wife and kids. He's sitting there. It's 2 a.m. when he finally comes in the house. And then this is the scene that walks into their home. He's bound. He's looks like he's been attacked. He has handcuffs on. He's dirty. And then he goes, oh, and by the way, they painted my throat with a hallucinogenic drug that could cause me to die.
So bizarre. Like, is he in the Peruvian jungle or in Haiti or something? It just seems like this is a drug that we're unaware of, but I'm sure it could exist. You know, like, there's those strange drugs, like in Haiti, there's that case of that man called Clarius Narcisse, where he died, or he was thought to have died. They buried him, did the whole funeral thing, and then he was found years later. I think he had some kind of brain damage. This has happened a few times in Haiti where, like, a witch doctor, I can't remember what they call them there, but they'll use a mix of, I think it's tetrodotoxin. It's from pufferfish, and it basically puts you almost in like a state of stasis. Right where somebody's heartbeat is like so low, they're not expending any energy. It can cause a huge amount of brain damage, but they use this, or they have in specific cases, used it to create like a force of people to work on their farms. So you basically have zombified these people to the point where they'll just do whatever you say. And yeah, that's a really interesting case, but that's the type of drug that is it just something that we're unaware of? Are these people so sophisticated that they've got access to drugs that I don't know. It's so bizarre to me. Chuck had driven back to the house in his own car, but he instructed Ruth to move the vehicle because he didn't want the people who kidnapped him to know he'd returned home. Not surprisingly, Ruth wanted to get him some medical attention. But Chuck wrote that if she told anyone about this, including the police, she would be signing a death warrant for the entire family. So Ruth would have to spend the next several days nursing Chuck back to health on her own at their home. This drug apparently rendered Chuck unable to eat or drink properly. So Ruth was force feeding him water with an eyedropper.
Oh my gosh. So in sickness and in health, this is what this vow is for. This is a lot. So Chuck is basically saying, do not tell anybody, right? Don't call the police. Don't take me to the hospital. Like, he can't even go to the hospital and say he had an allergic reaction or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, he pretty much said that. I think he's never told the full story about what happened, but it's almost like he's giving off the impression I'm not supposed to be alive. Like, maybe I was supposed to like just take off, or they were supposed to kill me. And if they find out I'm with my family again, then your lives will all be in danger. And I know I've seen some discussions about this case online where people are joking, oh, he probably went off on a 2-day bender to Las Vegas or something and got drunk. And he's just making up this sophisticated story to explain where he'd been. But the fact that he went an entire week without speaking and kept up this whole facade, I definitely do not think he was lying.
No. And I mean, literally, poor Ruth, he's putting her through hell and back. If you just want to go get drunk and be stupid, just say you're sorry and bring her flowers and pay the consequences.
Yeah, if he actually did go on a bender and this was an act, he's like the best actor ever. Because how do you pull off a full week of not talking and being fed water through an eyedropper? Like, that's pretty extreme. I think you could maybe keep up with that facade for a day, maybe two, but not an entire week. I'm inclined to believe him.
So at one point, Chuck wrote out the words, "My treasury ID is missing," and hinted that he had secretly been working as an agent for the federal government for the past few years. Finally, after a week, Chuck regained the ability to speak, but he refused to tell Ruth many specific details about what happened, only that he had escaped from his captors at Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix. Believe it or not, Chuck just decided to go back living his normal life again, even though he became a lot more paranoid. He grew a beard to change his appearance, started wearing a bulletproof vest every time he left the house, and carried around a .357 Magnum. He drove his daughters to and from school every day and instructed the school that no one else was to pick them up.
I can only imagine the trauma that this is causing to all the kids and, you know, the kids and to his wife. You won't tell me details, but what you'll tell me is maybe you were working for the federal government and our lives are at such a risk that our kids can't be with anybody else. You're wearing a bulletproof vest, you're carrying a gun, and you're changing your appearance. It's a lot to take in if you were the spouse or the kids watching your husband or dad do this.
And we have to remember, what was it, Robin, 11 days, 10 days that Chuck was missing initially?
This one was just 3 days, but he's going to go missing again for 11 days later on down the line.
Okay. WTF?
But seriously, though, what does that do to the kids? What does Ruth have to tell the children over that 3-day time period where dad's missing? And then when he comes back and he's incapable of speaking and formulating, you know, any sort of words, he can't feed himself or probably bathe himself or do any of these sorts of things. So what does that do to the children? And then what does it do to Ruth to end up having to keep this big secret when I'm sure all she wants to do is run to law enforcement and tell them exactly what happened?
Yeah. I mean, we all think about what happens when trauma occurs like this, what happens to poor Chuck, but then his disposition really has to weigh heavily on the rest of the family. And now you're telling me this is just the first big hurdle that the family's facing?
Yeah, they go through on more later on. And I have always wanted to hear Chuck's daughters get interviewed, because Ruth is interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries. She used to talk about a lot about this case in the media, but I've never heard his daughters on camera like say anything about this. And I kind of wonder if it was for their own protection. They just didn't want to get their faces and names out there. But I've always been curious to know how they were feeling while this ordeal was going on.
On May 11th, Chuck was subpoenaed by the State Banking Department and the Attorney General's office to answer questions about a state land fraud investigation, which reportedly involved Banco Internacional de Arizona. It sounds super fancy. And had possible connections to organized crime. Due to the secret nature of the investigations, no details about Chuck's deposition was shared publicly, but he'd recently received a $30,000 loan from Banco Internacional, which he was planning to use to help him buy controlling interest in Statewide Escrow Service Incorporated. In fact, the state banking department would not give Chuck the license he needed to operate the company until after he gave his deposition.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast. Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid. high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Even though he was offered protection in exchange for his testimony, Chuck turned it down. He soon managed to acquire controlling interest in Statewide and became president of the firm, but his success would be short-lived.
Do we know much about this bank? So I'm assuming this is some international bank. Is it like offshore? Is this actually in the United States in Arizona and some international aspect of the bank? What is that?
I'm just going to go double check. I'm curious if this is still around today. I want to see if this is an American bank.
Maybe it's a Mexican bank in Arizona because it sounds...
Yeah, it's got a Spanish name. It is in Tucson, so it is located there. I guess because it's so close to the Mexican border, that's why it has that Spanish name. But as we're going to talk about momentarily, Arizona was kind of a hotbed for money laundering and illegal activity during the 1970s. And while they never did release any details about this land fraud case or Chuck's deposition, I would not be surprised at all if that bank was involved in like money laundering for organized crime or something shady.
Yeah, it sounds like the kind of bank that would be involved in that kind of thing.
Well, I think a lot of banks have been involved in like laundering of cartels' money and like having cartels' money. It was like big banks like CIBC and like Hong Kong Bank of Canada and stuff that were known to have been holding cartel money. So I think that pretty much any bank, if the regulations are loose enough or if they can let it slip by, they're not going to say no, and they're not going to ask more questions than necessary. You might suspect something, but I think when you look deep enough into a lot of banks, you're probably going to see some dirty money.
Yeah. And for them, it's if money's money, you provide the documentation to open an account, we'll take it and get the interest from it and move on.
They're not in the business of like philosophizing over ethics, right? Like, we don't like this person, therefore we're not going to give it to him. Exactly like you said, if they provide the proper documentation, they check all the boxes, then of course they're going to take their money, right? They're not going to be like, sorry, we can't take your money.
So on the morning of June the 7th, Chuck showed up at his parents' house and told his father that if anything happened to him, there was a letter which would explain everything. Well, this alleged letter would never surface, and this turned out to be the last time anyone from Chuck's family ever spoke with him. Shortly after noon that day, Chuck called his office and said he would be arriving in 30 minutes, but he never did. 2.5 months after his last disappearance, Chuck just vanished without explanation again.
Okay, so never, this letter's never been found?
Nope, they have still never found it. They've never even clarified that it even exists, but that's what he said, and they just have never found out what the details of this letter were.
Robin, question. If you could choose to read this letter or the Jewel Kaler salad letter, which letter would it be?
Oh, this is a tough one. Don't put
this
me in that position. Yeah.
This
one has a lot of details that I don't know anything about. So it's definitely more mysterious, but I still will not die a happy man unless I can read the Jewel Kaler salad letter, because that's one of the big mysteries of the universe is how you can fit 8 pages talking about salad making.
Well, clearly, Robin, you don't know enough about salads either. If we don't know what would fill 8 pages of his letter.
I mean, I could imagine what Chuck's letter would say, given the sort of explanations that he gave. But I too want to know what Jewel Kaler had to say about the salad, because I don't know how one could fill that many pages. And I have a feeling that it would be just the type of letter that if you had it, you would want to read it to yourself every single day for the rest of your life.
Exactly. It's so true. Okay. So this is not, he's not going to be dead yet, right? You guys said he's just kidnapped at this point again.
Well, this one, he just vanishes, and it seems like he vanished voluntarily, but something's going to happen to him.
Okay. Okay.
9 days passed and Chuck's family never heard from him until Ruth suddenly received a phone call from an anonymous woman. She never identified herself, but she assured Ruth that Chuck was all right. This woman then decided to reference a Bible passage, Ecclesiastes 12:1-8, before she hung up. And rest assured, this passage is going to come up again, and we're going to go into more detail about what it could mean later on in the episode.
Wait, okay, so you're going to read this to us? Are you going to read us the passage from the Bible?
Yeah, not at this moment, but we'll go into more detail later on.
Okay, because I was like, wait a minute, which one is this? what does this say? Okay, so we're thinking at this point he has voluntarily disappeared. And then poor Ruth has no concept of where it is. His family's already been warned that if I disappear, there's this letter that'll explain everything. And then a random woman calls and says, don't worry, he's safe.
Yeah, and she decides to quote a Bible passage without giving any context at all, as far as I know, to Ruth. So I still, we're going to talk about it more, but I still don't know how this passage is significant and why Chuck would have wanted this woman to say it to his wife.
So bizarre.
So understandably, Ruth was quite baffled by this woman's call, but 2 days later, on June the 18th, she received some tragic news. Chuck had been found dead. At around 8 a.m. that morning, a pair of youths noticed Chuck's body on the ground outside his vehicle about 30 feet away from Arizona State Route 86. The area was in the middle of the desert, about 40 miles southwest of Tucson, and the police were quickly summoned to the scene. Chuck had been shot with his own .357 Magnum, and the gun was lying right next to him. It was determined that he had been dead for no more than 12 hours before he was found.
Well, the Pima County Sheriff's Department eventually ruled that Chuck's death was suicide. And there was gunshot residue found on his left hand, and there was no footprints or signs of struggle at the scene. However, there were a number of problems with the suicide ruling. Number one, Chuck was wearing a bulletproof vest. Number two, he was shot through the back of the head, which is a very unusual and difficult way to kill yourself. Number three, even though gunshot residue was found on Chuck's left hand, Chuck was right-handed. And Ruth said he wasn't very proficient with his left hand whatsoever. And number four, there were no fingerprints found on Chuck's gun.
WTF.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. So, I mean, literally, if I'm going to go complete suicide, I'm not going to be wearing a bulletproof vest, first of all. And again, the position of where he was shot in the back of the head, as soon as you said he was dead, I said, well, how? Like, how? And then you said from in the back of the head, that's a very abnormal suicide wound or entry wound for a gunshot. And the fact that I'm wondering if he could have reached his hand back and tried to like stop them from firing. And that's how residue got on his left hand or something. Because again, if you're going to do this, why use the hand that's weakest and could misfire, wouldn't be able to hold the gun as strongly, any of that?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking myself, is that you can get gunshot residue on yourself just by being in close proximity.
Absolutely.
To when the gun is fired. So that's how it could have been on his left hand. I mean, it sounds difficult enough to shoot yourself in the back of the head, but it just seems particularly hard if you're using your non-dominant hand, holding it behind your head and pulling the trigger. Like, there's just so much that can go wrong. And unless he wanted to make his suicide look as unusual as possible, I don't know how he could have pulled this off.
And I mean, especially in this case, because if you shoot yourself and it's not successful, then you end up paralyzed, you know, unable to even breathe on your own, those kinds of things, but you're alive. So I don't think if you really wanted to complete suicide that you would risk any way that it wouldn't be successful. And yet he seems to have done everything backwards in a way that would have set him up for failure and was still somehow successful.
Hold your non-dominant hand up to the back of your head and just see how uncomfortable that would be. Like, I tried doing it and it feels incredibly uncomfortable. Like, he's wearing a bulletproof vest. There's no fingerprints on this gun. Chuck's a pretty smart guy. If one wants to complete suicide successfully, like I read this in a pathology textbook talking about gunshot wounds to the head and saying that gunshot wounds that cross both hemispheres of the brain, so shooting oneself in the side of the head, has a far greater mortality rate than basically putting, say, a gun in your mouth or shooting through the back of the head. There's a greater chance of survival there. So I would think that if Chuck wanted to do this, he would have thought of a way where he would 100% be successful. There's just none of it seems to add up.
Well, this is not the only case we've covered on this podcast where it was ruled suicide, but there's mounds of evidence to point in the other direction. So there were so many other strange details about the crime scene. Chuck's car contained a cache of ammunition, guns, and CB radios, and it had undergone some modifications so that you could unlock the vehicle from the fender. Several
said,
yeah, I still don't understand how that fits in, but it's kind of the thing where he could like touch something on the fender and cause the vehicle to unlock. He sounds like James Bond here.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I said he just got equipped with a James Bond car. I swear to God, my conspiracy theory antennas of like, well, he's working for the government. It was easy to declare this a suicide and move on.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking is it was his own normal car that he drove his family around every day. And I still have no idea when he equipped this onto his vehicle, because that sounds like quite a challenge. But other strange details are that several sets of plastic handcuffs were found inside the trunk, and there was a pair of sunglasses inside the car, which apparently did not belong to Chuck. And one of Chuck's teeth was discovered wrapped in a handkerchief in the back seat.
Are you serious? Could like someone was torturing him and like pulled his tooth out and then was saving it?
I have no idea how this fits in. I mean, we still don't know how it was extracted. I mean, technically, someone could have punched him and caused him to lose his teeth. Or if it was a suicide, maybe he extracted it himself to make it look like he'd been beaten. What? But I still don't know how it fits in, the teeth.
Oh, my God. This is so weird. The tooth, right? Just one tooth?
Yeah, just one tooth. Yeah.
God bless.
There was no extraction equipment or like nothing he could have extracted a tooth with, right? And like no blood on his clothes that would make it look like he could have pulled out a tooth?
No, not that I know of. I never read anything about that. Like there was no blood on his clothing. I think the only blood was on the back of his head, and there were no pliers or anything or blood in the car. So it could have been just a case maybe someone punched him and caused the tooth to go flying out, but we still don't know the circumstances.
But then my thought is like, was he waiting on the tooth fairy or something? Because it's why you got to save it? Unless you were planning on rushing to the dentist.
You can put a tooth in milk, right? If you get a tooth in milk, go right to the dentist, you might be able to save that tooth. But
is that true?
Yeah, it's true. I've heard that. Oh, okay. Or I read that somewhere where you can't, it's not 100%, but it will preserve the root of the tooth, right? So if you can get to a dentist right away and a tooth gets knocked out, you may be able to save the tooth. It's not guaranteed, but I mean, he could have just been hoping to get a quart of milk. So he just stuck it in his pocket and was like, maybe I'll be able to see a dentist later today. But given all the other bizarre occurrences, that doesn't really seem to fit either.
Wow, that's crazy. It says place a tooth in a small container or plastic wrap and add some milk or saline to keep your root from drying out. Milk is a good medium for storing knocked out teeth because cells from the root surface don't swell up and burst as they do if you were to place it in water. Everyone write that down.
There was a piece of paper with directions to the location written in Chuck's handwriting, which seemed to imply that he was planning to meet someone there. He was also carrying a concealed knife inside his belt buckle. But the weirdest detail had to be the $2 bill clipped inside Chuck's underwear. And guess what was written on there? Ecclesiastes 8:12 was written underneath the word. And there was a set of arrows pointing to the 1 and an 8 in the bill's serial number. So this spelled out Ecclesiastes 12:1-8. The very same Bible passage the anonymous woman quoted during her phone call to Ruth.
Not to be inappropriate, but do you guys know the wine $2 Chuck?
What?
What's
Have
that?
You ever heard of the wine $2 Chuck?
No.
So in America, we have a very popular wine at this place called Trader Joe's. I don't know if you guys have Trader Joe's, but they have a very, very inexpensive wine called $2 Chuck. And here, poor Chuck has a $2 bill inside his underwear. So I just giggled to myself.
But you cracked the code. So now we know.
I did. He wanted a bottle of wine from Trader Joe's. Okay. I totally know. Okay. So Ecclesiastes 12:1-8. Do we ever know what that really means?
No, this is one of those big unsolved mysteries. Is we find out what the Bible passage means, but we don't know why Chuck wanted to quote this to Ruth. I mean, it's one thing to tell this anonymous woman to tell your wife about it, but the fact that he wrote it on the dollar bill and had arrows pointing to these numbers shows that he was trying to send out some sort of message. But I'm going to mention later in this that this is almost like a Dan Brown novel, like the Da Vinci Code, someone leaving like a coded message after their death, which is supposed to lead someone somewhere, but no one has ever cracked this.
And it's in his underwear. So like, obviously this is really important. He wanted to make sure that it was, you know, if something happened to him when he was declothed at the autopsy or whatever, that someone's going to find this in his pants.
Exactly. Like if he had kept it in his wallet, they might not have noticed the message on it, but the fact that he put it in his underwear shows that he wanted someone to find it if something happened to him.
So I looked up Two Buck Chuck wine because I was really hoping in my heart of hearts that whoever made this wine was inspired by the Chuck Morgan case, but it isn't so. The guy's name is Charles Shaw. So unfortunately, my heart is broken.
Well, you guys are really missing out. It's actually very good wine and it's very cheap. And I very much miss Trader Joe's.
You can't get $2 wine in Canada. That's for damn sure.
No, definitely not. But believe it or not, this is not the only weird thing about the $2 bill, because there was other stuff written on it. There was also a list of 7 Spanish surnames starting with the letters A through G. And I apologize in advance if I'm not pronouncing these correctly. But the surnames were Acevedo, Bejarano, Cajero, Duarte, Encinas, Fuente, and Gradilla. And that's not all. The back of American $2 bills all feature an artist's rendering of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and on Chuck's $2 bill, the individuals shown signing the Declaration were numbered 1 through 7.
And the passages were 1 through 8, right? So something about those numbers are important?
I think so, and I think maybe he only put 1 through 7 just because there weren't 8 individuals pictured on the bill, as far as I remember. But obviously, because he felt the need to number them, it's another kind of code here. And it's making me think of National Treasure with Nicolas Cage, where he finds all these clues to steal the Declaration of Independence. So I have no idea what the significance of him writing on that is as well.
Have they ever put professional decoders on this, or did investigators ever look into this, or was it suicide and done, like no investigation whatsoever?
Well, at the time, originally, it was pretty much suicide and done. And it was, we're going to talk more about it momentarily, but there was an investigative journalist who really pushed the case and did his own independent investigation. And I don't know, it was eventually taken to Unsolved Mysteries about a decade later. And I don't know if they ever took the bill to some professional decoders. I kind of hope they did, because the case went back into the spotlight. But if they found anything, they've never said so.
Well, I'm sure the professional decoders at like the CIA, like all of the 3-letter agencies were on top of this. And I 100% believe they probably know what happened based on their analysis of the bill, because I'm sure that they were all very curious. And if Chuck was working for the United States government, I'm sure that they figured out exactly what it means.
So is a conspiracy theory that he was working for the government, they wanted to keep whatever he knew quiet, and so they just said suicide and we're done?
That seems to be the implication. We'll go into more details about that later. But as you recall, he originally told Ruth after his first kidnapping ordeal, "My treasury ID is missing." So that's kind of what planted the seed that he was doing secret work for the government.
Wow.
There also appeared to be a crudely drawn map of some roads located between Tucson and the Mexican border. And these led between 2 towns, which were written out on the bill, Robles Junction and Salicity. There was also a ranch specifically identified near Salicity. And this location was known for having landing strips, which were rumored to be used for smuggling between the U.S. and Mexico. So what we can deduce is that this $2 bill appeared to have directions and possibly some sort of coded message that we've been alluding to.
Wasn't he trying to get, or wasn't he at some airport, some smaller airport when he got kidnapped the first time? So like here he is again, trying to get to this smaller airport to do God knows what.
Yeah, he had told his wife that he had escaped the first time around from some airport in Phoenix. So I don't know if there's any connection between them at all. But here he is mentioning another airstrip. And as we're going to talk about, like, it's rumored that a lot of drug cartel smuggling went back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico during this time period.
Yeah, I'm assuming these are these kind of private airports where very little, especially back then, very, very little security was there. If you had a plane on the, you know, on site, you just showed your ID and got in and left, and no one really asked any questions prior to things like 9/11 and things like that. But that's an odd link from when he first got kidnapped to now he's murdered, but he's trying to kind of almost perform similar tasks that he was doing that first time.
Mm-hmm. So on June the 17th, the day before Chuck's body was discovered, a man identifying himself as Charles R. Morgan had called police to his Tucson motel after claiming that some guns were stolen from his car. Oddly, the man said he wanted to know if the guns had been used in, quote-unquote, killing someone, but he would not provide any further details. According to the officers who spoke to him, Charles R. Morgan was definitely not Charles C. Morgan, which was Chuck's full name, but given the circumstances, police wanted to re-interview him. However, when they returned to his motel, the man had already checked out, and I do not believe he was ever tracked down. Nothing was ever found to definitively prove that Charles R. Morgan had any connection to this case, but if not, that's a pretty odd coincidence.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
That's a very odd coincidence, especially then when he's asking, was this used to kill anybody? Isn't he just reporting that his guns were stolen? And then he's assuming, now I want you to tell me if they've ever been used to kill someone?
Yeah, that's just what's so bizarre about it. Like, this is before Chuck's body has been found, so they haven't put two and two together yet. And just the fact that he says, oh, my guns are gone, could you let me know if they were used to kill someone? It's like, Jeez. Why would you just bring that up? And of course, once they found out that Charles Curtis Morgan was dead the following day, they tried to find this guy again, and they never did. So you have to wonder, what was his purpose? And was there a reason he decided to use this as a fake name?
Very weird. That's very odd.
That's so weird. It's sort of like the Mary Morris murders, right? Like, are they connected or are they not? It's sort of like this Chuck Morgan thing. Charles Morgan, is it connected? Because it's a pretty bizarre coincidence. You know what I mean? In such a short time span. And then just to off the cuff be like, yeah, my guns are missing. And were they used in a murder?
Yeah, they wouldn't even know that at that point. You're reporting them. And then how odd, like, were they used to kill someone? I'd be like, basically, we need to arrest this guy ASAP because something's going on.
Exactly. It's sort of like reporting your car stolen and being like, was it used in a bank heist? Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it turns out that even if his guns were stolen, that it wouldn't have had any significance since Chuck was shot with his own gun. So I don't know what he was trying to do here.
So 2 days after Chuck was found, the Pima County Sheriff's Department received a phone call from a woman calling herself Green Eyes. She claimed she was the same anonymous woman who'd phoned Ruth and quoted Ecclesiastes 12:1-8. Green Eyes said that she originally met Chuck 1 month earlier and saw him socially from time to time. After Chuck disappeared on June 7th, she met with him multiple times at the Easy 8 Motel. At the Easy 8?
That's a great title for a
that
motel.
That is a great name.
Sleazy 8. Yeah.
I wonder if they rent by the hour.
Yes. Yeah.
And the last time she saw him was on June 15th. He supposedly showed her a briefcase containing around $60,000 in cash and said he was planning to use the money to buy himself out of a contract the mafia had put out on his life. Chuck didn't provide many specific details, only that the contract was retaliation for testimony that he'd given to the U.S. judiciary in Washington, D.C. But if he was telling the truth, his plan obviously didn't work. Green Eyes said that she last spoke to Chuck by phone at around noon on June 16th, and he asked her to call his wife and let Ruth know he was okay. Fearing for her own life, Green Eyes refused to meet with investigators in person, and she was never identified. However, investigators did confirm that Chuck had stayed at the Easy 8 Motel, and Green Eyes apparently provided enough information about the case to convince them that she was telling the truth. A briefcase was found in Chuck's car, but it only contained business papers, and the $60,000 was never found.
Yikes. She had to know him to some extent because she knew to call Ruth. She knew who she was. She knew where he was staying. And I didn't know, once the mafia wants you dead, I didn't realize you could just pay that away. Seems like if there's a hit on your life for having too loose of a tongue, you're just going to die. I mean, I didn't know that you could just go, hey, by the way, here's $60,000, which isn't that great of an amount of money when you think about your life. And then just saying, oh, okay, now that you gave us this, it's totally fine that you gave information to the government about us.
$60,000 is a lot back then, though, for a hit, I would think.
It was.
Oh, my life?
Yeah. When you think of the value of life, sure, it's not a lot. But when you think of who Chuck Morgan was, he was an escrow agent, right? Like, I think I was reading now that, like, when people are putting out hits, it would be around, you know, you could do them for as little as $10,000, $20,000, I think would be pretty much par for the course from what I read recently. And I mean, of course, I could be totally off. I'm not an expert in hitmen, but this is a pretty high number because I don't know if we adjust it for inflation. We're looking at over $100,000, well over $100,000.
I think Chuck thought it was going to work, that it was so much money that the hitman would agree not to kill him. But I think what he didn't realize is that if you take a contract from the mafia and you don't go through with the job, then your own life is going to be in danger. Yeah. So he's not just going to take the money and let him live. So the big theory here is that this was a double cross where he met up with Chuck and agreed to accept the money, but then he just killed him anyway and made an additional $60,000.
Yeah, and took the money. You're exactly right. Once the mafia wants you dead, you're going to die. This is just not good. So I think you might be right, Robin, where they said, hey, yeah, I think that's a great idea. Let's meet. I want $60,000 and I'll just say that you're dead. Like, maybe we'll stage your death or something like that. And then he meets him, kills Chuck, and makes it look like nothing ever happened. But he walks away with the briefcase of money, or at least the money in the briefcase.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking, is that he probably proposed to the hitman, hey, because obviously if you use the logic that, say, the mafia takes out a contract on someone's life and this hitman doesn't deliver, they're going to find another hitman. Mm-hmm. So Chuck would need to disappear. He would need to say, okay, like, let's pretend that I'm dead. Maybe we'll take some pictures, stage my death, make it look believable. And then I'm going to go on the run to protect my family or whatever. And the hitman was like, it's just easier to kill you or whatever. I'm not going to risk getting in trouble with the mafia.
And the story gets even weirder. Chuck's office was ransacked and someone managed to break into his impounded car while it was in police possession. 3 weeks after Chuck's death, Ruth Morgan was visited at her home by two men who claimed they were special agents with the FBI. She says they pulled out their identification and flashed it to her very quickly before telling her they were looking for something. They proceeded to search through the house and pretty much tore it apart. Ruth was so flustered by the situation that she didn't even think to ask for a search warrant or take down the agents' names. They never said what they were looking for, and the implication seemed to be that they never found it.
Jeez Louise. Well, the thing that scares me about this impounded car, there was so much information that really was there when he died. And so the fact that they're in there trying to break out the impounded car or break into it and get stuff, there was the map, there was the code in the dollar bill, there was the money, there was this weird tooth wrapped up in the back. So it seems like some of that was at least very important to whatever this case was. And then poor Ruth, I assume she never got confirmation from the FBI that these were legitimate agents, correct?
Yes, she speaks to a journalist later on who checks with the FBI and they have no record of this visit. So we can't be certain that they were actually affiliated with the FBI. But this part of the story is what I briefly considered the possibility that this whole thing about Chuck working for the government could have been some sort of paranoid delusion and that he could have his entire wound could have been self-inflicted. But the fact that Ruth confirmed that these two men showed up at her house weeks later and tore it apart, I mean, there's no way anyone would do that unless Chuck was into something pretty deep.
Yeah. And then you have Ruth, poor thing. Like you said, she was so flustered. Does she know he's dead at this point?
But this was 3 weeks after Chuck's death. So she's in the grieving process. And then these two agents just suddenly show up at her door and pretty much tear her house apart.
Oh, that absolutely breaks my heart, because you have this, like you said, a grieving widow who's already just kind of flustered. She's got her kids that she's trying to help through the grief of their father's death. And now you've got these men, like, of course she didn't ask any questions. She's going like, oh my God, what is happening? Like, maybe they'll know what happened to my husband. And when they leave, that feeling of kind of dread and violation that would have come over her, they're like, were these guys, like, I didn't ask any questions. And then she's upset with herself for not really following through with questions she, quote, should have asked. That just makes me feel really sad for her.
Like, were they even agents? Like, they flashed their badges really quickly. I mean, maybe they could have been, but maybe if he had a hit taken out by the mafia, maybe they were two guys from the mafia and they just had fake badges. I mean, there's so many possibilities here because the story just takes so many twists and turns.
I feel like with the grieving widow, or at least I hope, I would pray that special agents were gentle enough to be like, hi, ma'am. You're like, this is what we're doing. You know, I'm agent so-and-so. You've got kids in the home, a grieving wife in the home. I feel like at least we could discuss with you and then ask you to please take a seat on the couch while we kind of go through some stuff. But I feel like there would be a more professional approach to it than like a quick flash and then like, you'll never talk to us again.
Yeah, it seems that this was not legitimate. If they were FBIs, they were there with for ulterior reasons.
Right.
So since the police didn't seem to be putting much effort into exploring this case, a local investigative journalist named Don Devereaux became involved, and Don started looking into Chuck's death. Given that Chuck had told Green Eyes that the mafia put out a contract on his life, Devereaux started to suspect that the case might be connected to Chuck's escrow work. Mafia activity was very prominent in Arizona during the 1970s, as it was an ideal location to establish a pipeline for smuggling narcotics into the U.S. The figure most responsible for this was Joseph Bonanno of the infamous Bonanno crime family. For decades, the Bonanno family played a prominent role in organized crime in New York City. But after suffering a heart attack in 1968, Joseph Bonanno agreed to retire as the boss of the family and moved to Tucson. However, while there, Bonanno helped establish the area as a haven for organized crime, and it's estimated that over 500 racketeers moved to Arizona during the 1970s.
Wow. And you're right. So this Green Eyes has this story that the mafia has a contract out on Chuck's life. She is so convicted about this story, she calls the police, with even though it remains anonymous, she's still telling them this information. So I think it's very probable that there was some kind of deeper financial tie to a mafia underground, or at least a drug kind of underground.
I mean, Green Eyes was terrified. Like, to this day, we don't know her identity because she did not want to come forward and speak to anyone personally. So you can genuinely think that she was terrified that her life would be at risk if she went on the record.
Even the name Green Eyes, doesn't it give you like that old school mob kind of feel? Like, didn't they call Frank Sinatra Blue Eyes?
Yeah, exactly.
Mickey Blue Eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And speaking of nicknames, I just wanted to mention that Joseph Bonanno's nickname was Joe Bananas. So they had some really cool nicknames with the mob at that time period.
That's awesome.
Well, Arizona also had a unique state law which allowed individuals to buy up land through numbered blind trust accounts. And as you can imagine, organized crime syndicates took advantage of this to anonymously conduct money laundering. It turned out that Chuck had done some real estate escrow work for at least one mafia family, and it's possible that they also used him to help with the purchase of gold bullion and platinum, which would have been a very convenient way to launder money. After searching through Chuck's records, Devereaux concluded that he probably started working with the mafia in 1973, and over the course of the next few years, was doing over $1 billion in escrow work in gold bullion and platinum. Ruth claimed that Chuck did mention at one point that there was money laundering going on in Tucson. He denied he was personally involved in it, but added, quote, "The less the girls and you know, the better."
Well, yeah, the less the girls and you know, the better. So this was maybe something that was being done legally due to some loophole in the law?
Yeah, pretty much, because Arizona had this law where you could buy up a whole bunch of accounts, but you didn't actually have to use your real name on them. They were called blind trust accounts. So it was so easy to launder money because you didn't have to worry too much about providing any details or giving any identity. So that's why like a lot of these organized crime figures from New York decided to relocate to Arizona during the 70s because they wanted to take advantage of this loophole. It was just so convenient for them.
So bizarre. I would love to know more of why that was ever put into place.
Well, Ashley, maybe you know more about this because you're from Florida, but around the same time, a bunch of gangsters started moving to Florida and there was something with property laws there that allowed them to shield their money. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know. But you guys tell me where I need to move next so I can shield my money. tell me where to go.
So the big question here is, did Chuck get involved in illegal activity for his own personal gain? Or was he actually helping the government fight organized crime? Remember, he hinted to his wife that he had secretly been working for the Treasury Department. After Chuck's death, the FBI did open an investigation into his case and even interviewed his attorney at one point, though it doesn't look like their investigation went very far. Years later, Don Devereaux made a Freedom of Information Act to the FBI, but they claimed they'd never even heard of Chuck Morgan, and they had no information about him whatsoever. They didn't even have a record of two FBI agents visiting Ruth Morgan's home. So there was obviously something pretty suspicious going on here.
Oh, the two FBI agents makes me really sad. This idea that these two men just literally violated this poor widow's home and her her safe domain, where this is the only place I feel safe right this second, And they just go in there and they ransack the home and pretend to be someone from the government. And then, I mean, I've never been a real big conspiracy theorist, but like if the government had a secret agent working for them and it was this kind of Bond escapade that Chuck was on, would they really share that information with the Freedom of Information Act? Like, couldn't that blow tons of undercover operations?
I guess it depends. Like, he's already dead by this point, but they may be worried about liability issues or something like that if they revealed that someone who was secretly working for us wound up being killed in the line of duty. I mean, we brought up this theory when we did our episode about Keith Warren, how the possibility that he was doing undercover work in a sting operation for the police and wound up being killed. And that was the reason the police were so secretive about it and tried to write off his death as a suicide, because they figured that would open up a huge can of worms if it turned out that he had been killed on their watch. So I kind of wonder if the same type of thing happened with Chuck. Well, Devereaux would not let this case die, and it eventually wound up in the hands of Unsolved Mysteries, who aired a segment about Chuck Morgan's death in February of 1990. During the segment, a lieutenant from the Pima County Sheriff's Department was interviewed and claimed that in spite of the suicide ruling, some officers from that department told him they did believe Chuck's death was a homicide. However, he said these same people eventually left law enforcement because they were in fear for their lives, and apparently, at least two of them went so far as to leave the U.S. After the broadcast, the phone lines at the Unsolved Mysteries Telecenter just lit up, and they wound up receiving over 600 calls. In fact, the Morgan case got more viewer tips than any other segment in the show's history up until that point. Devereaux personally investigated all the leads which developed from this and made some pretty shocking discoveries.
It turns out that large chunks of billions of dollars in gold bullion, which Chuck had purchased during his escrow work, originated from Southeast Asia at the end of the Vietnam War. Apparently, there were a lot of people involved in this operation, including members of the U.S. intelligence community from the CIA and the Department of Defense. Even some officials from the Vietnamese government who had been forced to go into exile after the war ended were alleged to have been involved. It seemed like the whole thing went far beyond just money laundering for the mafia.
So the government might have been a part of this as well. And then you have multiple international groups and countries represented in this deal. I'm very concerned and interested about these law enforcement agents who were working the case and said it might be a homicide, and eventually they actually flee the U.S. Like, do we know if they had confirmed death threats or what was going on?
Unfortunately, there's no information about that. It's just one lieutenant who was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries and kind of said that as a throwaway line that I know at least two officers who left the U.S. because they were in fear for their lives because of this case. And it's like, whoa, I need more details about this. But unfortunately, there aren't any. But that shows you how deep it was when you literally have police officers quitting their jobs and fleeing the country because they think this case is so terrifying.
Oh, my God. And of all people, like you said, law enforcement doing that. These are people who have the ability and access to, you know, hopefully they're supposed to be protecting us, and they don't even feel like they can protect themselves. They have to flee the country.
Yeah, very bizarre.
And this feels like one of those cases where people are like, oh, it's a bit of a conspiracy. The government couldn't do that. But we always have to remember, like, the whole Contra thing with bringing drugs into the U.S. You know what I mean? With the CIA bringing drugs into the U.S. And so the government is involved in nefarious activities from time to time. And sometimes somebody blows up their spot and we find out exactly what they're up to. But with regards to this case, we're just left to speculate with these little tiny details like, oh, yeah, a couple agents were forced to leave the country. It's super sketchy, and it makes you think that there's something bigger afoot here.
Well, one other lead that Devereaux investigated was a money laundering scheme which took place during the 1970s involving real estate from Willcox, Arizona. Chuck Morgan was alleged to be involved in this scheme alongside a friend of his, a Willcox real estate agent named Jack Tillman. Morgan and Tillman apparently met up during the 11-day period he went missing, and this is where Chuck possibly learned about the contract on his life. Morgan's death seemed to shake Tillman up in a big way, as he terminated his real estate dealings before he left the area and died of cancer in 1981. Devereaux also learned that Chuck kept a duplicate set of records for all of his illicit transactions, including the Willcox real estate scheme. He apparently believed that these records would act as his insurance policy in case his life was ever in danger. The Unsolved Mystery segment seemed to reinvigorate the case, but shockingly, another mysterious death would take place just 3 months after the episode aired.
Oh my gosh. Okay, before we get to that, So Devereaux says that he keeps this, Chuck kept this duplicate set of records for all of the illegal transactions he did. So he's confirming, of course, that Chuck was doing these. Do we know where these papers were? Is this kind of like that note that he had warned his family about that was never found?
I think so. Pretty much the same thing where they never actually did find the records. I don't know how Devereaux obtained this information, but I think he must have heard it somewhere that Chuck was doing this to protect himself. But if they got a hold of these records, then that probably explains why he was murdered.
And who's Wilcox? Is he ever talked to in any of these investigations, or he's just part of this random Unsolved Mysteries part?
Wilcox is a place in Arizona.
Devereaux's his business partner?
No, Devereaux's the reporter. Wilcox is the place, and Jack Tillman is the business partner.
Okay. Yeah. So sorry. Tillman, that's what I'm saying. Who's this Tillman guy? Was he ever interviewed, or what's going on?
He died of cancer in 1981, but apparently he just terminated his real estate career and left the area shortly after Chuck died. It apparently left a huge impression on him, but I don't think anyone got a chance to talk to him because I don't think they really dug that deep into the case until years after he died. So he took whatever secrets he had to the grave.
Okay. Because I was thinking if he and Tillman were supposedly meeting up right before he dies, obviously this guy knows something, but none of this information was known until after Tillman died.
Pretty much, yes. Gotcha. Like, apparently they found out that Chuck had met him during his 11-day period he was on the run, but I think this was probably second or third-hand information, and no one ever asked Tillman directly about it because he died of cancer.
Wow, awesome. Sorry, guys, that was a lot of names in one paragraph. Sorry. Oh,
yeah. Sorry, a lot of information in this case, yeah.
Yes.
At around 11 p.m. on the evening of May 14th, 1990, a 35-year-old Phoenix resident named Peter Douglas Johnston, who went by the name Doug, left his home to go work an overnight shift at the computer graphics company ICM Incorporated. Doug lived with his wife and 10-year-old daughter and had just gotten a job as a computer draftsman 2 weeks earlier. Later that night, Doug was found murdered inside his 1977 Toyota station wagon in the company's parking lot. It appeared that shortly after he arrived, Doug had switched off the vehicle's engine and headlight before he was shot at close range behind his left ear from about 12 inches away. For reasons I cannot fathom, the police initially looked at Doug's death as a suicide. There were several problems with this. No gunpowder residue was found on Johnston's hands. He was right-handed, which would have made it very difficult to shoot himself behind the left ear. And most importantly, there was no gun found at the scene.
We see this all the time. Why would you go straight to suicide, especially when you have circumstances like this? From the back of your head with the wrong hand, no gun and no residue on his hand, your first thought is suicide. Does not make any sense. And again, why don't we approach these cases where everything's a murder until proven otherwise?
I'll try to make some logic over the suicide ruling, because it sounds like the medical examiner concluded that because there was no direct evidence to point towards it being murder or suicide, his official ruling for the death was that it was undetermined. But come on. The only way it could have been a suicide is if Doug shot himself and some random person just happened upon the scene and decided to steal the gun before the police arrived. But I'd say there's pretty much zero chance that happened. I just don't know why you would instantly go to suicide when there's no gun.
Yeah. And this is, like you said, this is not the first time we've seen this. When you have, you walk up to a scene and you go, well, clearly this is not someone who killed themselves. And then in the reports, you start seeing suicide thrown away as an explanation. And this doesn't scream suicide at all.
Yeah. Somebody did not come upon the scene and steal the gun. This reminds me of the Cindy James one. You know, Robin and Ash, we talked about it. Robin and I just talked about it with Kate from Ignorance Was Bliss. And at the scene, there's none of the drugs are found, right? It's shocking because it just feels like an incomplete scene. And to settle on suicide, I mean, either they didn't investigate it properly and things were at the scene that they missed. And it's the same with this, but I think shooting oneself behind the ear where it would have had to have been the non-dominant hand, correct?
Right.
Yeah, and exactly.
Weren't her feet clean? And supposedly she would have had to walk like hundreds of feet or like half a mile to get to where she was, and her feet were pristine.
I think so. Yes. I'm trying to remember the
episode. Yeah, I think one of her feet was, can't remember if she had like one sock on or she was completely barefoot, but I think at least one of her feet was clean for sure. But I think Kate had said something about her wearing stockings, which, I mean, could account for the clean feet. But the most compelling thing in that case, I think, was the fact that the homeless guy who lived like 20 feet from where the body was found didn't see her in the days right. leading up to the discovery.
Right, right, right.
However, that was a perplexing lack of motive for homicide in this case. By all accounts, Doug was at a very happy place in his life, as he had previously worked as a forklift operator at a food warehouse company before he went back to school and graduated with honors at ITT Technical Institute. He didn't seem to have any enemies or skeletons in his closet. And while he did have $14,000 in student loans, he was hoping his new computer drafting job would allow him to pay them off. And all of his valuables, including his wallet, watch, and wedding ring, were left behind at the scene. So robbery was definitely not the motive. The murder seemed completely random, and the crime scene bore all the hallmarks of a professional hit. But why would anyone want to target this guy? Well, guess who lived directly across the street from ICM Incorporated's parking lot? Don Devereaux. But we'll go into more details on this in part two of our episodes. So I think this is a good place to end part one.
Dun, dun, dun. Cliffhanger there. So I want to thank you all for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget that we are brand new. And any chance you have to share us on social media with a friend or to rate and review is greatly appreciated. You can email us at thepathwentchilly@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at thepathwent. So until next time, be sure to bundle up because cold trails and chilly paths call for warm clothing.
Music by Paul Rich from the podcast Cold Callers Comedy.
So I want to thank you all for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget that we are brand new. And any chance you have to share us on social media with a friend or to rate and review is greatly appreciated. You can email us at thepathwentchilly@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at thepathwent. So until next time, be sure to bundle up because cold trails and chilly paths call for warm clothing.
Music by Paul Rich from the podcast Cold Callers Comedy.
Hi, I'm Muriel and I love true crime.
I'm Nick and I think Muriel's obsession is weird and disturbing.
During the pandemic, when we were cooped up with nothing to do, I started forcing Nick to listen to me tell him about whatever true crime story I was consumed by at the moment.
And I gotta admit, I found Muriel's insane storytelling very entertaining.
Now, every week on our new podcast, Muriel's Murders, I handpick a real-life crime story that I think will blow Nick's mind.
Muriel is really enthusiastic about researching and telling me these stories, and they are a lot.
Some stories are famous. Some are relatively unknown, but all of them contain crime, violence, and murder from across history and around the globe.
Muriel's Murders is a podcast about true crime. But really, at its core, Muriel's Murders is about two people trapped in their apartment with nothing but time on their hands, attempting to understand each other.
It's an exploration of murder, human nature, and the importance of compromise in a marriage.
So join us every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. And check out our original Muriel's Murders animations on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok at Muriel's Murders.
Hey, Nikki, are you ready for a story?
No!
Okay, let's get started.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.